Ljubljana, Bratislava, Amsterdam, Bucharest,
This is Network Europe. Coming up on the programme, do Europeans need or want to get any closer together? As Romania and Bulgaria prepare to join the EU in 2 months' time, we look at how they're being welcomed or not.
If you become a victim of exploitation, you don't know who contact for help. And that's why you might end up without money, without any help and without hope.
And as the banlieue burn, we look at inner-city deprivation and what's being done to stop the rot. These stories and a lot more, including November's quiz, in this edition of Network Europe, a partnership of Europe's leading broadcasters, with me, Richard Walker. Thanks for joining me. Also coming up a bit later...
Yeah, me, my telephone.
That year, the world's first commercial automatic mobile phone system opened in Stockholm.
Nobody talk to me.
But first, Europe's getting bigger all the time, and our leaders in Brussels are keen for it to keep expanding. And there are plenty of states keen to join. Turkey and several Balkan states are currently front of the queue to start negotiations, while Romania and Bulgaria become full members at the end of the year. What some predict will happen then is a mass migration as East Europeans seek better wages as they go west. So what do Europeans think of the expansion and the prospect of the continent experiencing a massive labour force on the move? Network Europe's reporters have been out on the streets of the capitals to find out.
I think there are too many here, too many. I'm not the only one who is afraid of them. I think it's, the most of the people are.
No, I don't fear workers from the East. I think they are a great plus for our society.
I don't fear them. I think they are good for our economy.
No, definitely not. I think it's a very good thing that the EU has expanded and is integrating the old Iron Curtain countries.
So everyone loves migrants, or maybe that's just the effect of having a microphone thrust under your nose by a pushy journalist. A recent poll in Britain found that 8 out of 10 people believed migrants took jobs from British workers. An open-door policy for migrants doesn't therefore seem like a vote winner. We don't know exactly what effects these workers have, but one thing's for sure, they are coming and Britain says it's closing the door. Radio Prague's Ian Willoughby has been finding out what effect the massive Polish immigration wave has been having on Britain.
I was very surprised just after Poland's EU accession. I could really see how many more Polish people are in the streets of London. And nowadays you can see many, many more. Almost every month, every few months, you can see the difference.
Says Agnieszka Okońska, a journalist with the London-based Dziennik Polski, or Polish Daily. She isn't alone in being very surprised by the number of Poles and citizens of other new member states who have come to the UK since the European Union enlargement of 2004. Official British government estimates suggested 13,000 migrant workers would come to the UK every year. But in reality, perhaps 600,000 have arrived in just 2.5 years. Professor John Salt of the Migration Research Unit at the University of London says these figures are unprecedented.
I think it's undoubtedly the largest ever single wave over a short period. It's sometimes compared with the flow of Huguenots, maybe 100,000. Relatively, perhaps the Huguenot flow in the 16th, 17th centuries was bigger in terms of its size relative to the UK population, but certainly not in absolute numbers. In absolute numbers, this is, I think, the largest ever single wave of migration. And Poles, the largest group in it, are probably the largest ever single national group who've come in.
One reason the impact of Eastern European workers has been felt so strongly is that they don't follow the same patterns as other migrant groups, says Professor Salt.
They have come to the big cities, but they're more spread around the country than migrants who've come in over recent years have been. You find that in East Anglia, for example, in the southwest, in more rural areas, quite substantial numbers have gone there because a lot of them work in agriculture and agricultural-related industries like food processing and food packaging. So they are, in a sense, beginning to change the geography of foreign nationals within the UK, reduced focus on the large cities, particularly London, and a rather wider distribution, including rural areas.
In urban areas around the UK, go into any cafe or supermarket, and the chances are you'll be served by a young East European. And they are young. 4/5 are estimated to be under 35. But as time passes, some are starting to climb the labour ladder, says Polish journalist Agnieszka Okońska.
A lot of people are doing menial works. A lot of them work in hotels, au pairs, nannies, barman, barmaids. But also you can see that there are more and more Polish people also doing accountancy jobs, or they work in the offices of different companies. Also, we had recently some statistics on Polish people working in the city, and there is really more and more on doing much more responsible jobs.
But things don't always go so well for these young migrants. Jan moved here from Slovakia after May 2004 and now runs a free magazine for Slovaks and Czechs. When we met outside a pub on a noisy road in North London, he told me many are struggling.
The biggest problem is unrealistic expectations, because there are a lot of people are coming without any knowledge of English, or they speak just few words, and they have expectation that they will very soon find good job and earn a lot of money, and their English will improve and all this stuff. But very often it's not true. A lot of people are struggling, and there is maybe 20% of people who has big difficulties to survive here.
And in the worst cases, they can end up on the streets. A recent study by the organization Homeless Link found that 15% of the homeless in the British capital are from Eastern Europe. Agnieszka Okońska again.
You might be subject to all sorts of exploitation. If you become a victim of any sort of exploitation, you don't know who contact for help. And that's why you might end up in Victoria without money, without any help, and without hope. Poland's initiated some actions to help people who are in Victoria, and so we have some Polish humanitarian organizations coming here and trying to help these people.
Getting back to the mark these migrants have made on the UK itself, in some areas Roman Catholic churches have seen dramatic rises in attendance, while some schools, in rural areas in particular, say they're having trouble meeting demand. Shopping has also changed. There's been a rise in the number of Polish grocers, while some of Britain's biggest supermarket chains have now begun stocking delicacies like the cabbage-based golabki and flaki, a popular soup. However, the biggest impact has been on the British economy.
The independent studies that have been carried out looking into the effect of the migration in 2004 have pointed to net positive impacts, and have actually said that they've enabled the Chancellor Gordon Brown to meet some of his economic growth forecasts. So we do see a very, very net positive effect, and the evidence points to huge benefits in terms of economic growth, productivity.
Says Zaki Moore, director of the Business for New Europe Group, who represent some of the UK's biggest employers. But not everyone agrees with this outlook. Some point to a growing strain on public services. Others, business leaders as well as tabloid editors, are concerned that migrant workers, often willing to work for far less, are forcing wages down and undercutting locals to the point where they're putting some out of business. I put that argument to Zaki Moore.
Well, I mean, I think that argument is often put forward, but that depends on one's view of these workers. And the fact is, these workers are doing jobs which UK workers are not doing. So they're fulfilling a role that's complementary rather than competitive to UK workers. We don't think that there's a huge impact on the wages necessarily, as has been articulated by some in the media in the UK.
Business for New Europe campaigned unsuccessfully for Britain's open door policy to be extended to workers from Romania and Bulgaria. But in any case, restrictions don't apply to the self-employed, and many thousands more will be accepted under a quota scheme. And with many still arriving from Poland, Lithuania and elsewhere, East European workers look set to keep making their mark on the UK for some time yet.
Ian Willoughby with that report there. And of course, it's not just in the UK that Poles have been looking for work. Since Spain opened its labour market to workers from the new EU member states, Poles have been searching for jobs there too. But Spaniards are beginning to fear the influx of migrant workers more and more, despite the fact unemployment between July and September hit its lowest point in 27 years. Poles used to take up just seasonal jobs, but now many of them have decided to stay for good. Radio Polonia's Ivona Lehmann has been meeting some migrant workers on their tea breaks.
Officially, Spain issued almost 12,000 work permits for Poles last year, but on the spot one immediately finds out there are hundreds of thousands of them, even though many might say the language is a bit of a problem. As it usually is in a tourist country, there are plenty of seasonal jobs going and Poles definitely snatch them up first. When Alicia arrived in Barcelona at the end of June, she could hardly say a few words in Spanish, but when she got the job as a waitress, the knowledge of English turned out to be much more useful to her and her Polish friends.
I met quite a lot of Polish people who came to Barcelona to work just for holidays. Not all of them spoke Spanish, that wasn't necessary, there is lots of Irish pubs where you can work even without Spanish.
Now Alicia's nearest plan is to take up studies in Spain. When Grażyna was first looking for a job or trabajo in Spanish, everybody pointed at another side of the pub or restaurant, informing her that cigarettes are there. She couldn't get through with her Spanish since tobacco and trabajo may sound similar. Relations with her first employers turned out also very tense.
When I came here, I found a flat to live in and then a job. But from my first two jobs, I was fired within a month, without any particular reason given to me. I think I just spoke poor Spanish, and the employers took advantage of that. The first one even valued my work for only €2 per hour. I couldn't believe it. It became very difficult for me to make ends meet. Thankfully, friends helped me to find this job. I've been working for an Englishman on Costa del Sol for almost 3 months, have good relations with my Spanish manager, and I finally earn decent money. I'm sure this will allow me to stay longer in Andalusia now.
The language barrier is probably one of the main obstacles why Spain can't beat England or Ireland in terms of the size of the immigrant Polish community. The wages are lower here, with an average about €5 per hour, but it's not so bad, the Poles say, since life's generally not too expensive, and Poles still have a chance to save up before they come back to Poland. Mike Sauter, the head of current affairs at REM radio station in San Pedro, says since tourism is so popular in Spain, people will gravitate mainly in that direction, which often means seasonal jobs.
There are many, many people from Eastern Europe here in Spain. I think the main reason that happened was last year Spain had an amnesty as regards having to live here legally or illegally. And a lot of people from Eastern Europe were already here but weren't legally resident in Spain. And Spain said, OK, we're going to change all this. And that encouraged people to come. So, for example, you will find a lot of Polish people, Russians, Ukrainian, Lithuanians, working in restaurants and bars, helping out in houses and gardens and jobs like that.
As experts say, one of the things that helps Poles find employment in Spain, even though they just start learning the language, is the good reputation they have earned in other countries that flung the doors open to Polish labourers ahead of Spain. For Network Europe, I'm Ivana Lehmann.
OK, so that's life for the migrant worker at the unsung end of the scale, but what about life at the top of the Euro tree? Romania and Bulgaria have just had commissioners appointed to the European Commission, you know, where the policies get made. Our man in Brussels is Stephen Castle, and he told me Romania had some trouble deciding who to appoint.
Romania had really some big difficulties over this. It's a big job being a commissioner, and it comes with a big salary, around about 18,000 euros a month. And therefore people subject the nominees to some scrutiny. The initial candidate, Mr. Vozganian, was criticised by MEPs in Brussels on the left because of his links with big business, and also criticised in Bucharest for having allegedly cooperated with the Securitate during the communist era.
And now, that was enough to see him off?
Well, it was. I mean, Mr. Vozganian didn't admit that he'd done anything wrong, but he conceded that this was not really in the interests of Romania to have a long, protracted argument over his candidature, and he withdrew. So that left the field clear for Romania's former EU negotiator, Mr. Leonard Orban, who was duly appointed early this week.
Stephen Castle in Brussels there. Now, as Western Europe prepares for large-scale migrant movement, here on Network Europe we've been asking if young people in search of work are likely to fare any better than the disadvantaged second generation of migrants now living in Europe's deprived suburban districts. Last year we witnessed an orgy of car burning as social unrest and protests swept the towns and cities of France. But France isn't the only country with a disaffected Muslim minority. That's Dutch Moroccan Rhymester with the song that he thinks sums up the Dutch attitude towards people like him. It's called Kut Moroccana, or Damn Moroccans. Now, the Dutch Housing Minister Pieter Winsemius spoke out this week warning that many Dutch inner-city districts could go the same way as France unless something drastic is done. Radio Netherlands, Andy Clark.
It was very outspoken indeed. Pieter Winsemius certainly pulled no punches. He said that billions of euros would have to be spent within the next few years to prevent some 40 districts in the Dutch inner cities really sliding out of control. Those were his words. The problems are, of course, the well-known problems of the inner city areas, like we've seen throughout Western Europe, the problems of unemployment, crime, and poor housing. And yeah, these need to be tackled immediately, the minister said, and he has identified these key problems. Let's hear what he had to say.
Because we start finding out that first of all we have major problems in a large area still, so there's no you can't sleep, you can't just fall asleep. And we also know that what we can do about it. We have learned from the past experience of the recent years that there is a way of doing this by the physical restructuring of whole neighborhoods. Now, physical has to go together with social, and we are learning those lessons, how to do it now. And once you know these lessons, you can't close your eyes.
Radio Netherlands, Andy Clark in The Hague, speaking to Dutch Minister Pieter Winsemius. Well, the starting point for all discussions of deprived suburb violence is still the rioting in Paris last year that stunned Europe, and the problems that led to those incidents have not gone away. Most young people of North African origin living in France's deprived suburbs, as French citizens, are entitled to vote. But a nationwide campaign launched last year has failed to convince young people to go and register to vote en masse. Many of them say politicians are out of touch with their lives. Radio France International's Nick Champeau reports from Paris.
If you're not happy with the government, turn out and vote. That was the message of last year's campaign. Several weeks after the riots that rocked the country's impoverished housing estates, actor Jamel Debbouze, rapper Joey Starr, and film director Mathieu Kassovitz told young people in Clichy-sous-Bois that casting a ballot was a better way of voicing their grievances than torching their neighbor's car. Mohamed Meshmash was one of the organizers of the event in Clichy-sous-Bois, north of Paris, where last year's riot started. He says that in his town, the campaign has led to results.
Ça a été une réussite totale. Il y a eu plus de 1000 inscrits en l'espace de 15-3 semaines. Donc on a quand même.
It was a total success. More than 1,000 people registered in less than 3 weeks in Clichy-sous-Bois. We launched similar events in smaller cities. They received less media attention, but they also led to results. We're actually considering organizing a nationwide operation with all the organizations we worked with in more than 100 cities. The idea is to organize an event in all these cities on the same day to encourage people to register to vote.
Donc ce serait une journée nationale pour l'inscription sur les listes électorales.
Flocks of journalists attended last year's campaign, but it seems that nationwide it has had a limited impact. Macarena Nuño works for a Paris-based organization called Civic Awareness and Democracy.
Following the data that we have, there were only an increase of 1% in the number of people that went to register in the election rolls next year.
And is that satisfactory?
We, as an association, we would like more people to get in, to go register in the electoral rolls. All our day-to-day life is organized, let's say, by laws, by political decisions of, for example, having more transports or what kind of education we want, what kind of health system. So by going voting, you can choose the person who will represent you the best.
Voting is not compulsory in France, but all that people have to do to register is to go to their town council, produce their national identity cards, and prove that they live in the area. But Macarena's campaign is not likely to convince this group of young adults in the Cité des 4000 in La Courneuve, a troubled housing estate north of Paris.
La politique, c'est des démagogues. Parce que
politicians are full of demagogy. They think we're stupid. Why should we vote? They don't know us, and we don't know them either.
Pourquoi voter? Ils nous connaissent pas, on les connaît pas.
Moi, j'aurais 18 ans, j'aurais voté. Enfin, s'il y a quelqu'un pour voter.
I would have voted, but I'm not 18. That said, there's no one to vote for. I don't understand their language. It would be easier if they spoke French, but they speak politician. They should go back to school.
Etc. Claire Charabia. S'ils parleraient en français, ça aurait été mieux. Ils parlent politique. Il faudrait qu'ils retournent à l'école d'abord.
Xavier Lemoine is mayor of a poor suburb near Clichy-sous-Bois called Montfermeil. He is with the UMP center-right ruling party. He says it's young people who have to make an effort, not politicians.
What I try to explain to young people, and it's not an easy task, is that they have to make efforts. I think we have failed to explain to them clearly the rules of our society.
Jean-Marc Ayrault is the head of the socialist group at the National Assembly. He has welcomed delegates of organizations based in the suburbs. He is hoping that his party will get their members' votes, but he knows that the socialist candidate is under a great deal of pressure.
I understand that some are no longer interested in politics, but the young people we met told us that they had the power to vote and to change things, but they don't want to be disappointed. So I am well aware of the fact that if we socialists do win the election next spring, we won't be allowed to make any mistakes. We cannot disappoint them.
The onus is now on politicians. They have up to the 30th of December to speak the right language and get more young people on the electoral registers. The first round of the presidential elections is on May the 5th. Paris, Nick Champeau, RFI.
You're listening to Network Europe, a partnership of Europe's international broadcasters. Right, here's what mine sounds like. Sweden is a proud parent this year. Its baby is turning 50. Gabby Katz has this report on the world's first fully automated mobile telephone system. You might want to bend your knees to pick this thing up, though.
Anytime, anywhere. Mobile phone technology has revolutionized how we live our lives. Swedish telecommunication experts are happily calling Stockholm the home of the mobile phone. I visited the opening night of an exhibition that takes us back to the beginning, 1956.
You ever need my telephone?
That year, the world's first commercial automatic mobile phone system opened in Stockholm.
Nobody talk to me and keep me company.
Mia Sundén from financial periodical Veckans Affärer showed me that first mobile phone, which required the user to be a bit of a bodybuilder.
Its weight was 40 kilo. You managed to make two or three calls. Then the battery on the car was out of order. What they say is that you made a call and then you had made a call for services. It was like an old-fashioned phone. You called and was connected automatically to the ordinary telephone system.
And it looks like an old rotary phone that the top has just been lifted off it and yeah. Reused.
Yes, exactly. It was not so reliable.
I am your destiny.
A far cry from the pocket-sized, bling-covered gems of today with their polyphonic ringtones.
Here we have the latest models, much smaller, much lighter, and of course much more reliable. And now you can call everywhere and you can take photos and you can get email and so on. And of course today latest services in TV and the mobile phone as well. So this 50 years have happened quite a lot of.
50 years, what about a midlife crisis? Everyone has them. Where can the mobile phone go to from here?
Actually the fastest growing markets in the developing countries like Africa, in Asia and so on. Today 2.5 billion people have a mobile phone. It's actually the fastest growing technology in mankind. If you compare it to the PC or internet, we have 2.5 billion users for mobile phones, 1 billion users for internet, and 900 million or a billion of PCs. So it's more than twice as big, and it's still growing faster than ever. Last year, we added about 400 million new users in the world. So I think it will continue for quite a long time.
And what has it meant for Sweden?
It's one of the, I would say, base industries. It stands for more than 10% of the Swedish export, gives work, employment to approximately more than 150,000 Swedes, and I think it's one of the biggest inventions in modern Swedish history, I would say.
2.5 billion people can't be wrong, but what do you think mobile phones mean to our lives?
To stay connected. I was in India in April, and what I saw, I could even send an SMS. I see an elephant walking on the street, and I think that's the big thing with mobile phones. You are so direct.
Sweden's Ericsson is the world's largest maker of mobile phone networks. The company reported that third quarter profit had grown by 17%, boosted by strong results at its co-owned handset maker, Sony Ericsson. And as the world's number one company in its field, Ericsson is proudly watching those 50 candles being blown out on this particular birthday cake. Jan Udenfelt is senior vice president.
It's really fantastic to see that we have been now 50 years with a mobile phone. And we have to remember that Sweden was the first country to start with a mobile phone. So this is the origin of the mobile phone. And I think this is fantastic to see. And we have been at the forefront. Ericsson always been at the forefront when developing these new technologies. And the best example is maybe GSM. GSM is today more than 2 billion users in the world. And Ericsson was first to the market 15 years ago, installing the first GSM networks in Europe.
Any sneak preview? What's to come?
Next step is what we call mobile broadband. And this means that the broadband technology, also using laptops and things like that, can be used when you are traveling around. And you can always get in contact. With the latest 3G technology, we can offer up to 4 megabits per second. So it is really, truly broadband technology.
From the futuristic back to the basics, Östen Mäkitalo has been described as the grand old man of mobile telephony.
I have been working with the Televerket, Telia, Telia Sonera for a large number of years. When I came into this, the mobile telephone business, it had already existed for 10 years, the first system. And what we did at that time was that we took note of what had happened, although there were only a few hundred subscribers. And nevertheless, it showed us the potential. And we could use the kind of thinking that, think if this could be made much smaller, much cheaper, think if it could be made in such a way that you did not need to know where you are. People could still phone you. Their signals could reach you wherever you are in the world. Then this could be the property of every man.
The way forward often requires a little daring. Was mobile telephony immediately recognized as the gold mine it was, or was it considered risky business? Was it crystal clear that this was going to be the next big thing?
Definitely not, because as late as by the end of the 70s, when we were discussing, when we were buying equipment, high-level people in both the industry and also our administration thought that, okay, the penetration could maybe reach up to 2-3% of the population. If they had known that it is a multi-billion business, I don't think they had allowed us to go on with.
But are you a mobile phone-a-phobe? Don't worry. as Veja Sandén from Veckans Affärer reminds us.
There's always a button that you can switch it off, say, if you want.
Or you can do what a friend of mine does and just never take the mobile out of the house. Don't know why he's got one, really. Now, I promised you this month's Network Europe quiz. Don't bother Googling it. I just tried it and came up with nothing useful at all. As you know, we love to fix quotas on everything here in Europe, and of course, those products all then have a quota surplus. So this month's question is, how many Olympic-sized swimming pools would the European wine lake fill? Answers, please, to contact at networkeurope.org. Special prizes to the winner. That's all we've got time for today. This programme is a partnership of Radio France International, Radio Sweden, Radio Polonia, Deutsche Welle, Radio Netherlands, Radio Romania International, Radio Slovakia, Radio Prague, Radio Ukraine and Radio Slovenia. Network Europe will be back next week. On behalf of our pan-European team, this is Richard Walker. Thanks a lot for joining us. Stop mijn hart erin. Dus ik meen het als ik rap ben, daar staat ding. Waardoor ik ben als Zabrek Krim in 1921. Overgaaf is voor de zwakkeling. En ook al is het jaren geleden, de geschiedenis herhaalt zich eens een paar keer gebleken. Veel van jullie gasten hier zo waren tevreden. Tot je de rims zag feesten met Marokkanen en Ede. Maar je was weer te volbaren geweest. We vierden feest omdat ik toen pas was jaren geweest. Het is nu tijd dat ik wat aandacht besteed aan actuele problemen en mathematisch bespreek over wat er onder Marokkaan hier leeft. Onterecht worden we gehaat en gevreesd. Vooral speelt erop in en met name TV. Maar als jij eraan meedeed, dat verbaast me nog steeds. Ik ben aardig op dreef en als ik eenmaal begin houden, moet die man me stoppen, want ik kan me niet meer inhouden. Dit klinkt misschien eenvoudig, maar ze kijken maar alsof ik klook in de Twin Towers. We kwamen hier als gastarbeiders, onderdaan loopt het goede hart verspreiden. Ik weet nog hoe ze me noemden, vroeger ik was wat kleiner. Kut, maar ook klaar, dat is wat ze zeiden. Ze willen ons wat maken.